Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is March 4th. Is that right? It is March 4th. So practicums are starting this week, and so there's a practicum this morning, practicum this afternoon, a couple on Wednesday. So if we look at the schedule here, indeed it says March 4th, practicum 1 for both the Monday and Wednesday labs. Today we're going to cover axial skeleton. We sort of covered that already for a couple of classes in lab. But we're just going to go over some more things. But you guys want to know a top secret, something? Something that's top secret, very valuable? Top secret, very valuable. I probably should even mention this. But your SI leader is a tutor as well. So the top secret, very valuable, Christina's back. Raise your hand, say hi. Okay, so if you think you're struggling in class, I'm sure she can help you out one way or another. And see me during office hours too. Thank you. All right, so anybody have any questions? So far, so good? Okay, I'll put that away. And start with axial skeleton. So what you can see, well, I guess I just have to minimize that. So what you can see, slide on the right, okay, is a skeleton, and it's broken down into two main components because you see two main colors with it. And what are those two main components right there that you see? Yeah, you see parts of the skeleton, you see bones, okay, but you see some lighter colored bones, maybe a gray color. That's the axial skeleton made up of the skull, vertebral column, rib cage, and sternum. Right, and that even includes the sacrum way down over here. And then the other bones that are color-coded in beige or green or yellow, whatever color that is, that's the appendicular skeleton. Right, so these are the bones that make up your upper appendage and your lower appendage. I don't really want to say arm and leg, because what is your arm? It's between your shoulder and your elbow. Right, so if I say arm, it's just that one bone. And if I say leg, what does that mean? That's between your knee and your ankle. There's only two bones in your leg. Right? But we want to study all the bones of the appendages, not just the arm and the leg. So just as a review, what do we call this between the hip and the knee? That's your thigh, right? It's part of your lower appendage. And between your elbow and your wrist, what's that called? That's the forearm. That's not your arm. You might think it's your arm, but it's not really. Okay, so let's go back to the slide on the left. And let's talk about some of these landmarks on bones. All right, so you're going to have to be familiar with these landmarks. Okay, a rough raised spot on a bone is almost always used for muscle attachment. Here is a good example, mastoid process on the temporal bone. It's a raised area, and if you palpate it with your fingertip, that just means feel it with your fingertip, you're going to find that it's very rough. It is not smooth. That is usually for muscle attachment. So a big, strong muscle is going to be pulling on this part of the bone. And guess what a bone does when it feels stress, if it feels a muscle pulling on it? It gets bigger, just like that muscle. When you exercise that muscle, it gets bigger and stronger too. Bones get bigger and stronger because they are living tissue. And you should probably know the names of the cells. We talked about that, three names of bone cells. Okay, a tubercle is another kind of process for muscle attachment, but it's in a few locations of the body. It's a special process. The same thing for tuberosity. It's a little bit bigger, and a trochanter is even bigger still. It's a really huge, rough, raised area on a bone in particular. You're going to find out where it is, but it's on the femur. Epicondyle, what does epi mean, like epidermis? On top of. So here is a process that is on top of a condyle. Yeah, and a condyle is a raised, smooth area on a bone for articulation. So here is a process which is going to be really rough. It's a raised area on a bone, and it doesn't really participate in the joint, but either a muscle or a ligament attaches to it. Malleolus, that's also a process. That's what makes your ankle bones stick out. A crest, a spine, and a line are all processes, but for instance, here's the stylus process on the skull. A crest or spine or a line is elongated. Okay, so it's going to be a process, but it's very long. It's not, it's on the surface of the bone, unlike the styloid process, right? It comes off the bone, very small location right here. So that's the difference between a crest, a spine, and a line. Okay, depression. A depression is a bowl, and the function of a bowl is to hold something. Okay, and so here is a bowl right here that accepts the condyle of the mandible, so it's called the mandibular fossa. So fossa is a good term, good anatomical term for depression. There are a couple others. If it's a very long depression, more like a trough, then we're going to call that a sulcus or a groove, same thing. Right, a sulcus or a groove is a really long depression in a bone, or it could even be in some nervous tissue or other kinds of tissues as well. And an alveolus, again, is some kind of depression. So what's the function of an alveolus? It's for? It says right here, for holding something, right? So it's a special kind of fossa for holding something. And if we look on the slide on the right, okay, we can sort of imagine where it is, but there's a big depression in the mandible that the tooth root fits into. It holds the tooth in place. In lab, we have some mandibles and maxilla that are missing teeth, and you can look right down into the alveolus to see that. Okay, and then the edge of an alveolus, does anybody know what the edge of an alveolus is called? Yeah, the edge of anything is called a margin, right? So the alveolar margin is the edge of all of these different alveoli. Okay, and a hole in a bone. Here I see a hole. It goes into the bone or all the way through. A hole is what we call a foramen. Foramina is plural. And why do you need a hole in a bone? What's it going to be used for? Passageway, just like this doorway over here. It's a passageway where people get in and out of the room. We could call that a foramen, okay, but that would confuse the mathematicians in the building, so we don't want to call it a foramen, okay. A meatus is a hole in a bone, but it doesn't go all the way through. In particular, here is the external acoustic meatus. It allows sound to enter the temporal bone, but that hole doesn't go all the way into the brain, thank goodness, right? It stops, and so that's a meatus instead of a foramen. A canal is a foramen, but it's very long. It's more like a tunnel, right? More like a tunnel. I don't know, that might have been me. And a fissure is like a sulcus or a groove, but it's very deep. So a fissure is something, for instance, you don't want to fall into because it's really, really deep. And a cavity in a bone is what we call a sinus. I think we looked at some sinuses in lab, like there's one in this bone right here, which is the frontal sinus, and then there's one in this bone over here, which we call the maxillary sinus, and then there's one in the sphenoid, which we can't really see from this perspective very well, and there's one in the ethmoid bone as well. Okay, paranasal sinus. Smooth articulating surfaces. Bones will be smooth in certain locations if it's making up a joint, because these bones are going to move up against each other, and if it was a rough surface, then they would just grind each other down and away from each other. So a smooth raised surface is what we call a condyle, like the mandibular condyle we see right here, palpated in lab, probably you all have done that, and that is a nice smooth surface. And it can be a process sticking up like that, but it could also be a depression. If it's a little tiny depression that's smooth, then sometimes we call that a facet. Do I have that under bowls? Oh, no, I could put that under there, facet. But it's for articulation. Oh, here it is. Facet, that's a depression. A head is also usually the proximal end of a bone, but there's a couple where it's the distal end of the bone. And it's a raised surface, and it helps form an articulation. And here are a couple that we're going to look at on Wednesday. Right, they're part of the appendicular skeleton, but I want to tell you about them right now. Trochlea and capitulum. These are some smooth processes that help make up your elbow joint. Really important processes that make up the elbow. I know the first time I heard trochlea and capitulum, I just freaked out and said, I'll never remember these words. Right, so I'm just going to introduce them to you today, and then we'll really cover them on Wednesday really well. Okay, and then, of course, what do we call an extension of a bone making a 90-degree angle to the rest of the structure? And here is the mandibular ramus, right? So that's a nice 90-degree bend compared to the body of the mandible. Nope, there's a couple others. And it could be used for other parts of anatomy as well. It could be used for nervous system or even vascular system, right? As a matter of fact, some of these names can be used certainly for other systems in the body too, like nervous system, for instance. And so that's why it's good to know the names of these things, because then when I mention the central sulcus, you know, oh, well, that's a depression. As a matter of fact, depression in the brain. And we're going to find out where that is when we get to nervous system. Okay, axial skeleton. I have listed as number one, and then number two, appendicular skeleton, made of the arms, legs, and the girdles. Okay, the girdle is something that helps attach your arm and your leg to your body. We're going to look at all of these things next time. That's why I have it in parentheses on this slide. Today we're going to look at axial skeleton. And I just wrote down the number of bones that make up these different divisions of the axial skeleton, like skull has 28. You don't have to memorize that number. Okay, this is just to give you sort of a sense of how complicated these different structures are. And hyoid bone. How many bones make up the hyoid bone? It is just one. Yeah, we looked at it in lab, kind of a horseshoe-shaped bone, kind of follows the curvature of the mandible, and it's inset inside the mandible. Vertebral column, 26 bones. Thoracic cage, 25 bones. All right, so there are a lot of bones that we're going to look at. The skull. We looked at this in lab already. Here are a bunch of the bones, and you're familiar with, for instance, parietal and frontal bone, ethmoid, sphenoid. Right? These are bones that make up the cranium. So these are what we call cranial bones. They protect the brain. And so, for instance, since they're protecting the brain, it's really handy to know the names of these bones, because you learn a lot of neuroanatomy at the exact same time. So, for instance, what bone do we have right here? Frontal bone. And what lobe of the brain is deep to the frontal bone? That's the frontal lobe. And the parietal bone is right here, right? Just posterior to the frontal bone. There's an important lobe of the brain just deep to the parietal bone, and we're going to call that the parietal lobe. So it really helps you a lot in anatomy if you become familiar with your bones, because you learn muscle anatomy, vascular anatomy, neuroanatomy all at the same time. Even though right now you can't appreciate it, but it's amazing what you're learning right now even. A Wormian bone is kind of a funny bone, right? And I think I have a picture of a Wormian bone someplace in here. Ah, here's a Wormian bone. Okay, and these sutures, which is a joint between the flat bones of the skull, it's an immovable joint. Sometimes these sutures don't form exactly line up. You can see they have a lot of, it's really convoluted, these joints, which means it has a lot of twists and turns. And sometimes there's so many that it forms like a little island of bone between two major bones. Like here are two sutural bones between the parietal and occipital bones. And sometimes they're called Wormian bones as well, because the suture here reminded somebody of a worm. That's right, a worm. Okay. All right, so those are cranial bones. And then the other bones, right, are facial bones. And these make up the face. They don't protect the brain, but they're important for articulation, for eating, for breathing, communicating with the environment. And so here are some facial bones. Upper jawbone is the maxilla. The lower jawbone is the mandible. And then the cheekbone is the zygomatic. Right. And then the bridge of your nose is made with a pretty small bone. That's the nasal bone. Right. Doesn't protect the brain. And right behind the nasal bone, well, you get the maxilla right here. And then behind that is the lacrimal bone. But the ethmoid bone, it really is a cranial bone, because it helps protect the brain. It's really not a facial bone, and you see it's not really on the face for you to see. And indeed, ethmoid bone is a cranial bone. All right, what are some other facial bones? Lacrimal we talked about, all of these we talked about except for the vomer and the palatine bone. And in lab you got to see these palatine bones. Let me see if we have anything that looks like a palatine bone. I don't think we do. You'll have to find it in lab. Okay, and it looks like an L. So if you make an L with your thumb and index finger and hold it up so your index finger points up, your thumbs become what we call the horizontal plates, okay, and your index fingers become the vertical plates, and they kind of come together like this. The horizontal plates make up the roof of your mouth, and the vertical plates make up part of the nasal cavity that's up in your nose. Where did we go? Ah, here. Okay, lacrimal maxilla. Oh, we talked about, oh, vomer. Okay, let's see if we can find a vomer. A vomer helps make up part of the nasal septum. And the nasal septum is just a wall that separates a cavity into two subspaces. Or it separates a space into two subspaces. That's what a septum is. We're going to see some important septa when we look at the heart. But in particular, how about if we have, oh, here's a nice view, anterior view of the skull. Okay, so here is the nasal cavity, and you can see it broken up into right and left nasal cavities. The bottom bone right here is what we call the vomer, and the top bone is part of the ethmoid bone. So this is the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid bone, and the vomer really doesn't have any kind of plate associated with it. It just looks like a long, flat blade of a knife is what it looks like. The other things that I see inside the nasal cavities here are these little shelves or wings that are sticking out. These are the nasal conchae, and there are three. There's an inferior, a middle, and that also means there's a superior, which we can't see because the nasal bones are in the way, and as a matter of fact, we might not see them very well anyway because they're really small. The superior and middle nasal conchae are part of the ethmoid bone. Maybe you could tell that by the color, because this one right here probably has the same color as the superior part of the nasal septum. But the inferior nasal concha is a bone all by itself. It's a standalone bone. All right, so the middle and superior part of the ethmoid, but the inferior one is a bone all by itself. And this helps you breathe, because it acts like wings, just like the nasal septum here. It prevents turbulence from developing inside the nasal cavity, and whenever there's turbulence in a fluid when it's moving, it's high resistance, so it doesn't like to move through that particular space. But if it flows in nice laminar sheets without turbulence, then this air will flow through your nose very nice and easily. During the day, maybe that's not such a big deal, because if you run short on breath, you can just consciously, since you're awake, take a deeper breath, make up for a deviated nasal septum or some malformation in the nasal concha here. But at night, when you're sleeping, okay, that's going to cause big problems, because you'll wake up or partially wake up to take a breath, right? And we call that sleep apnea. So these things really do have to be positioned properly inside the nose. Or maybe they should be fixed, and of course you want to speak to a physician about that. Okay, so that's most of the bones of the skull. Here we can see the sphenoid bone. From here it goes all the way across the skull and even makes part of the orbit. It's the posterior aspect of the orbit. And sometimes we call that, this is the greater wing and this is the orbital surface of the sphenoid. Okay. Okay, so that's all the bones. Now in lab, you do have to learn a bunch of these pieces. Right, but we already know how to name some of these things. Like here is a hole. What are we going to call that hole? That's a foramen. And in particular, this whole region of the mandible is called the mental region. So we call that the mental foramen. There's also a muscle right here. And guess what we're going to call that muscle? The mentalis. A lot of people don't like anatomy because they have to learn muscles. But here's an example of where you already know some that are pretty obscure unless you know your bones. All right, so that's really handy. Okay, so there is a foramen. Here's another one that's below the orbit. What's the name for below in anatomy? Infra, so here's the infraorbital foramen, because here's the orbit, here's the supraorbital foramen, and sometimes in people it's just a notch. And so that would be the supraorbital notch. And here's another hole. That's what a nerve from your eyeball goes through to get to your brain, allows you to see. So that is the optic canal. Here is a foramen, but it's really long and narrow. What do we call a long, narrow, deep depression? Yeah, so we got a fissure right here. So here's the inferior orbital fissure. Here's the superior orbital fissure. Some of these things make really good sense that they're named that way. All right, since I talked about the mandible, I want to go to the mandible and point one other thing out. Pretty nice illustration. Of the mandible right here. So again, you can see You can see the body of the mandible, mental foramen, maybe should be a little bit more anterior. And then here's that socket that the root of the tooth is fitting in. That's a depression inside the mandible, which we call an alveolus. Yeah, that's the alveolus. And here's the alveolar margin. Here's another margin. Here's another margin. And then we got another mandible. And you're probably wondering, gee whiz, if this is the mental foramen, why don't we just call this the mandibular foramen? Well, we can't because it's already taken by this one right here. On the medial surface of the ramus of the mandible, that's the mandibular foramen. Now, you don't have to know this projection coming off, but you can dig around in there with your fingertip after you wash your hands and feel that it's really prominent. That's a really nice landmark. For instance, when a dentist or a hygienist injects Novocaine to numb sensation in the mandible right here. So because the nerve comes out, and that's exactly where you want to squirt that Novocaine. All right, so if you go on to other disciplines, you'll even have to know more anatomy than what you're learning in here. There are some other really tiny bones, and we call these auditory ossicles. There are three of them. And as a matter of fact, I could hold them right here between my index finger and my thumb, okay, and even get closer to you guys like that, and I could ask you, do you see them? And you would say no. But you know what? They're so small, you couldn't tell if I was holding them or not. Okay, and as it is, turns out, I'm not holding them, but you couldn't tell. That's how small they are. Right? They're inside the temporal bone, within the petrous region of the temporal bone. Okay, and there's a malleus, incus, and stapes. They transmit vibrations, sound vibrations, from the external ear through the middle ear into the inner ear for this sense of hearing. Right? And so if these don't work, guess what you are? Deaf. You have a hearing deficit. Exactly right. Maybe that can be overcome with a hearing aid. Okay, other bones, hyoid, nasal conchae, we talked about. Cavities. Well, the cranial cavity. Let's take a look at the cranial cavity. I didn't go over this in lab at all. Okay, but we've taken part of the frontal bone, part of the parietal bone, part of the occipital bone off. We just cut it off with a nice circular saw. Okay, and we've removed that from the skull. What do we call this thing right here? It's not one particular bone. It's called a calvarium, right? Just a skull cap. So we remove the calvarium and look inside the cranial vault. All right, and we see a number of different depressions. It's a bilateral system of depression. There's one here, and then there's one over here. This sort of is like one depression. This is what we call the posterior cranial fossa. And then here is one, so this holds the occipital lobe because that's the occipital bone right there. And then there is another fossa. We call this the anterior cranial fossa. Here's the frontal bone. So guess what lobe of the brain fits right in this fossa? The frontal lobe, exactly right. And then here's the middle cranial fossa, and that holds the temporal lobe of the brain because we see the temporal lobe. And here is the internal acoustic foramen. If we were just to kind of sneak around the side, we could see the external acoustic foramen. And then if we connect those two, meatus, internal acoustic meatus, external acoustic meatus right here. If we draw a line between those two, then we run right through the petrous region of the temporal bone. And that's where you would find those three little bones. What's the name of those three little bones once again? Yeah, those are the three that allow us to hear. All right, so this is the view that I particularly like. And this is an exam figure. You should know be able to name all these foramina. And on one side, I think the foramina are labeled over here. And then on the left side, the bones are labeled and some important landmarks on these bones are labeled as well. And what did I say my favorite bone was in lab? Did I admit that to you guys? The ethmoid bone, I did. Okay. And here it is, right? It's a cranial bone, so it helps make up the cranial cavity. This is what we call the cribriform plate. It's a horizontal plate, and it has a bunch of holes in it. What are we going to call these holes? Olfactory foramina, right? Because olfactory nerves move through the cribriform plate into the nasal cavity for the sense of olfaction, which is what? Smell. Okay. And then here is something that's sticking up, which we can't see from this perspective very well. It kind of resembles a shark's fin, and that is a crista galli. right? Notice two L's in golly right here. And that's really important because it holds on to a really strong, important membrane that surrounds the brain, right? And so the crista galli right here is important because it prevents your brain from sloshing around inside your head when you look right, look left, or look up and down, okay? So that's another reason why I like the ethmoid bone quite a bit. All right, I think we went over all these structures in lab, except for maybe the hypophyseal fossa right here. In your lab book, we call it the cella turcica. The cella turcica is an indentation in the body of the sphenoid, and it houses, it holds, right, because it's a fossa, it holds the pituitary gland. And another name for pituitary gland, because a lot of things have more than one name, is called the hypophysis. Hypophysis, below the hypothalamus is really what that means. So the hypophyseal fossa is what? A fossa that holds the hypophysis or pituitary gland. So that's going to be important for you to know forever. That's a really important, because the pituitary gland is so important in all of us. All right, don't forget foramina are holes for passageways. So here's foramen magnum. What passes through the foramen magnum? The spinal cord, right. So the brain stem is about in this region, and as soon as it gets into the foramen magnum right here, then we call it the spinal cord. Right, spinal cord from foramen magnum down through the vertebral canal inside all the vertebrae added up together. Okay, so we talked about all of these things. Went into a little bit more detail in lab. All right, so let's turn our attention to vertebral column. Vertebral column. So here is vertebral column. Where's a better view? Better view of vertebrae. Ah, here. So here is the vertebral column. It's made out of vertebrae. Some of the vertebrae are nice and distinct from each other. Others have fused together. Like the sacrum is five vertebrae that have fused together. Way down here helps make up the pelvic cavity. And the coccyx, these vertebrae have fused together as well. And this is a variable region. I count four vertebrae right here, but you could have three, you could have five. All right, we just call that anatomic variation. And it really doesn't matter. The coccyx, which I see right here, really doesn't have any clinical importance unless you break it off, and it hurts really bad. All right, but it really doesn't do much. It's just a vestigial organ from when our ancestors had tails. Right? And I've never met any of those ancestors, right? That's millions and millions of years ago. So this is evidence of what? This coccyx right here is evidence of evolution, yeah. But it's certainly not, it doesn't prove that evolution is a theory, but it just supports that theory. Okay, so here are all the vertebrae. And you can see some have letters like L and a number. That's how we name most vertebrae. And so this L stands for the division that this vertebrae is in. All right, so let's look at the divisions. The superior division, there are seven vertebrae, we call that the cervical division, which makes up your neck. All right, so these are cervical vertebrae, you got seven of them. The necks make up your thoracic cage. There's a rib that attaches to these. So these are what we call thoracic vertebrae. And then down below, the thoracic vertebrae, we got lumbar vertebrae, and then all of those are supported by the sacrum. So the sacrum is holding up all of your body weight, so it's got to be pretty big and strong, a massive bone right here. And there are usually about five fused vertebrae. Okay, so we got seven vertebrae for cervical, 12 for thoracic, 5 for lumbar, and you could just memorize that, or if you have photographic memory, that would be really nice because you could just look at this picture in your mind. But I don't even know if I know anybody with photographic memory. Some people, if you do, let me know in lab. I'll make you take a photograph of something, and then I'll test you in your mind. Okay. So how are you going to know? There's seven cervical vertebrae, 12, and 5. Because there's a little saying, okay, that you have breakfast at 7, and you have lunch at noon, and you have dinner at 5, okay, and noon really means 12, all right? So that's one easy way to know. 5, probably like the sacrum resembles your hand. How many fingers do you have in your hand? 5, okay? how many digits do you have in your hand? Five. So that's how many vertebrae make up the sacrum. It's unusual that we would actually say, if we're talking about this vertebrae right here, number seven in this region, it would be rare that we would say cervical number seven, because it just takes too long. Nobody has time. We have less time than we have money, and we don't even have money anymore. So we don't say cervical, we just say C, which means cervical. So C stands for these superior seven vertebrae. And then for the thoracic vertebrae, remember we don't have time to say thoracic, we would just say T, right? So here is T8, here's T9. That's how we would name these vertebrae. And then down over here in the lumbar division, I'm pointing to L4. Right, and then here's L5. The abbreviation for the sacral vertebrae, if we want to talk about one of these in particular, these would be called S, right, for sacral. And then right over here, the coccygeal, what would we use for coccygeal? Coccygeal number one. What would be a nice abbreviation? Okay, well, if you say C, you're talking about cervical right here. So, you know, it's so rare that we talk about it. Sometimes we have to write it in a report. You would say capital C, little O, for these vertebrae down here for coccygeal. All right, so I guess if you have to talk about them, you still have to say coccygeal because you don't want to say CO1, CO2. I've never heard anybody say that. Okay, so that's how you name these. And these thoracic vertebrae are defined by the number of ribs that attach to the vertebral column. It has to be a thoracic vertebrae to have a rib attached to it. And if there's no rib attached to it, then it can't be a thoracic vertebrae. So there's just always a one-to-one correspondence between thoracic vertebrae and the number of pairs of ribs you have. So on this diagram right here, you could tell me, what is the normal complement of ribs? How many pairs of ribs does a normal person have? It says right here, 12. Okay. And if you have 13 pairs of ribs, guess what you have? You have an extra thoracic vertebrae in this location right here. And that's an abnormal condition. It's not a pathological condition. It happens every once in a while. There's some anatomic variation in that. But remember, abnormal just means different from whatever the average is. Doesn't mean pathological. And somebody might be missing a vertebrae too in this region. Okay, so if we look at the vertebral column from this anterior view, and the anterior view we see the vertebral bodies all lined up, and here's the anterior view of the sacrum. And if we look from top to bottom, it looks pretty much like a straight line. Okay, but there's a little bit of curvature to it, normal, because your heart is going to be right here, mostly on the left side, and that's going to put a little deviation into the vertebral column right in that region, in the thoracic region. That's going to be normal. And if we look from the side, we see what? Even more curvature within the vertebral column, and that's important because we're going to look at these curvatures. Here is, okay, a convex curvature. We call that the sacral cervical curvature. And then here's another anterior curvature, or what we're going to call a convex curvature in the lumbar region. And then here is one that's bending the other way. And then also down here is one bending the other way. So here's the thoracic curvature. Here's the sacral curvature. Okay, these curvatures are in these parts of the body because they're acting like a fossa. They're holding something. So the thoracic curvature is holding some important organs, like your lungs and heart have to be in this location right here. So there's a little posterior curvature. And there's a posterior curvature or sacral curvature in the sacrum because this is holding some other organs. Like what kind of organs would be here? Reproductive organs in particular, okay, in the pelvic region. All right, so but if your spinal cord was all posterior, if we loaded up your body with a bunch of organs and the spinal cord was posterior in your body, what would happen to you when you stood up if all that weight was behind you? You'd lose your balance and fall over. Okay, so a way to balance the weight of your head is to have some of these anterior curvatures. These anterior curvatures help position weight over the more central region of your body so that it's easier to maintain your balance and walk around. All right, so that's important. So that's why there's the lumbar curvature and the cervical curvature to help you maintain balance. All right, what else about vertebral? We're going to go over this quite a bit in lab. Oh, but here's a nice typical vertebrae. This is going to be a drawing exercise for you guys in lab, so you're going to be familiar with it. It's also an exam figure, and it's a nice simplified vertebrae. This part right here is the massive part of the vertebrae. This is what the weight of all the vertebrae above it rests upon, and all the weight of your body rests upon this part. This is called the body of a vertebrae, or the centrum. It's big and massive. And this is one bone that suffers a lot from osteoporosis, unfortunately. And since it's designed to hold up body weight, when somebody has osteoporosis, this body can actually collapse. All right, so that's a good reason to do what when we're young? Have calcium, vitamin D, okay, and what else? Phosphorus, yeah, phosphorus is important too. Okay, but one other thing, and everybody just loves to forget about this one, including me, which is exercise, right? Exercise when you're young, that makes these bones stronger so that you can afford to lose some calcium before they get too weak to support your body weight. Okay, so here's the body. Some bony plates that come up from posterior from the body. Remember, this is anterior. So this is pointing into cavities inside your body, thoracic cavity, abdominal cavity, pelvic cavity. Here's the posterior view. And you know this is posterior because you could run your fingers down your neck or down your back, and what do you feel? A bunch of bumps, right? And those bumps are the spinous process that's poking straight posteriorly away from the vertebrae. All right, let's get back to this bony plate right here. Running posteriorly from the body, this is what we call a pedicle. And then there's another bony plate that curves back toward midline, but still a little bit posterior. This is what we call a lamina. So these just have different sections within a vertebrae. So the pedicle is between the body and this process that's sticking way out to the side. This is what we call a transverse process. It's sticking out to the side. That's the pedicle. The lamina is between a transverse process and the spinous process, which is sticking straight posteriorly. And you can have fractures in one region or another, right? And so we have to be able to talk about those very specifically because we want to really take care of this vertebrae if it becomes damaged, right? So there could be damage to a lamina, there could be damage to a pedicle, and we're really concerned about those different areas, and it's probably treated a little bit differently as well. So if we put two lamina and two pedicle together, that forms the vertebral arch, which is some armor plating for the spinal cord that goes through this hole that we call the vertebral foramen. Okay, so that's, I think, what I want you to draw on the diagram. Then it gets a little bit more complicated because there are some smooth depressions right here. What do we call something, or what is a bone use a smooth surface for? Okay, condyle, what's the function of a condyle? It's for articulation, it's forming a joint. So you're wondering, well, what kind of joints are in your back? Well, there's all kinds of muscles. Remember, a function of a process is muscle attachment, and look how rough it is. Oh, I just noticed this the first time. I don't want to tell you what I see right here, because you'll see it like that forever then. Okay, I'll tell you, I see a thumb and a thumbnail right here, but that's not what I want you to see ever, okay? Okay. All right, so here are these depressions, and they're smooth. They're used for articulations, but they're called facets, right? A small fossa, tiny, tiny, tiny fossa. We don't call it a fossilito. We just call it a facet, and it's smooth for articulation. And so there's a rib that's going to articulate here, and there's another part of that same rib that's going to articulate here, and that's why we call these facets, right? It's just kind of the inverse of a condyle. It's a depression. And then this vertebrae has to articulate with the superior one, the one that's right above it, and it does with this particular facet. So we call this the superior articulating facet. And if we look on the underside, the inferior side of this vertebrae, then you're also going to see a facet that articulates with the vertebrae underneath it. And we would call that the inferior articulating process and facet. All right, so that's really want what I want to say about these vertebrae. So you see a lot of joints. This is before I got sidetracked. I see a lot of joints in your back, right? Every vertebrae has, at least on this one here, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and here's 7, and then the other side is 8, all kinds of joints. And then we got hundreds of muscles that attach to these big processes that stick out. And guess what? You have pain receptors in all those joints, all those muscles, all those ligaments. And that's why a lot of people, okay, one reason why they suffer pain in their back, because this is a very complicated area, and any damage to the back will cause muscles to go into spasm or pain sensations, right? It's very easy because it's a complicated area. That's one particular reason. When we get into nervous system, we'll look at another important reason. And that other important reason has to do with, let's look at this figure right here. Pretty good. This one right here. Maybe a little bit better. Better still. Okay, so here we see part of the vertebral column cut away. Here's the body, transverse process, spinous process. And here's a superior articulating process. Here's an inferior part. So I see another superior articulating process on this vertebrae. And if we put these two vertebrae together, I see another hole right here. If we take the vertebrae apart, it disappears. We can't see it. It just becomes a notch. Right? So we looked at the vertebral foramen, which makes the vertebral canal that runs through here, posterior to the bodies. But this foramen is called the intervertebral foramen. This is how nerves leave or enter the spinal cord. And if this foramen becomes damaged, or this disc, intervertebral disc, evulses into the space right here and causes compression of a nerve, that will cause a lot of pain as well. Right? Or maybe even motor deficits. Motor deficit is a motor function is something that moves your body, as opposed to sensory, which brings in sensation to your brain. Okay? So nerves have to enter and leave through the intervertebral foramen. Check that out in lab. Okay, cervical vertebrae. Well, I guess I do want to talk some specific things about certain kinds of vertebrae. They have some characteristics which allows you to tell what division they are from, just by looking at them, even from across the room. And I'll start to tell you what some differences are. Okay, if we look at, here's the whole vertebral column. Okay, and we said that they're usually given the name by the division that they're in and the number from superior to inferior. But there are two that are so special and so important that we actually give them names besides giving them a letter and a number. And here they are. C1 and C2 have special names. C1 holds up your whole head. It articulates with the occipital bone. And so here is the articulating surface on C1. What do we call that articulating surface on the occipital bone? It's a raised area. Generally, what do we call a smooth raised area on a bone? A condyle. Right. So there is a condyle on the occipital bone, and who knows what we call it? Nobody knows? Yes, the occipital condyle. Okay, so the occipital condyle articulates right here, and this is what we call C1. C1 is holding up the whole head. That reminded somebody of a mythological figure that's holding up the whole world with these two hands and two arms. And I think it's a guy, but I'm not sure I really know that for sure. And the name of that person is Atlas, right? So C1 is also called the Atlas. And the joint between the atlas and the occipital bone kind of looks kind of like a little elongated, like something you'd put a banana split in right here. This fossa, kind of long and narrow, which means that the occipital bone can rock back and forth in this depression very easily. So if your head rocks back and forth in this depression, what do we call that motion? I don't think we studied motions a lot, but in everyday language, you would call this the yes motion, right? That's your favorite answer to everything. So the yes motion is allowed between the occipital bone and C1. But if we were to look at the joint between C1 and C2, we would see that it doesn't allow for any kind of rocking motion. Right? And that's because the body of C1 is missing. Let's take a look at C1. The body of C1 is missing. So here is C1. This is Atlas. And the body of C1 should be right here. Here's the posterior part of C1. And you might say, well, where did it go? Here is C2. And here is the body of C1 attached to the body of C2. So this forms like a spike that goes superior from the body of C2. We call this the dens, and it also has another name. It's called the odontoid process. Right, that's the body of C1 that has now fused to the body of C2. And C1 can rotate around the dens, so the dens kind of act like an axle, right? And C1 kind of acts like a wheel. And so the name for C2 is called the axis. Right? So C1 is atlas, C2 is axis. And you should probably know that. Right? Here's C1 in the spinal cord, here's C2, atlas and axis. On this illustration, I also see one way that you can always tell a cervical vertebrae from any other kind of vertebrae, because I see two additional holes. Here's a transverse process. Here's a transverse process. Doesn't have much of a spinous process, but there's a tubercle there. Tubercle is a process for muscle attachment. And in these transverse processes, guess what we find? A foramina. And we call these transverse foramina within the transverse processes. These take important blood vessels from really close to your heart directly up to the brain going through the vertebrae, through these transverse foramina. And since it's going through these vertebrae, you already now know the name of that blood vessel. It's called the vertebral artery, vertebral vein that goes through these vertebrae, through the transverse foramina. So any vertebrae that has a transverse foramen or transverse foramina, then it has to be a cervical vertebrae, because anything below the level of your neck is not going to take blood to your brain. So there's no reason to have a vertebral foramen in any of the other vertebrae. Any cervical vertebrae, C1, C2, C3, C4, C5, C6, where should I stop? C7, that's right. Have transverse foramina, no other vertebrae does. None of the T's, none of the L's, none of the S's, none of the COs have transverse foramina. So that's really easy to see, even from across the room. Okay, what else did I want to say? Oh, I wanted to say something about thoracic vertebrae. So let's look. Does that look like a thoracic vertebrae to you? And why? I heard a yes. Guess what? I like that answer. Because not only do I see a vertebrae here, I see something else, which is what? A rib. Here I see a rib, and what kind of vertebrae, by definition, has a rib attached to it? Thoracic. So it's got to be a thoracic vertebrae. So let's look, let's analyze this vertebrae to see what it has special that allows this rib to attach to it. Well, here is a facet right here, which is a smooth depression. We said that was for a joint. And then here's another facet over here. Smooth depression, that's for a joint. And what it articulates with, right, this one right here on the body is articulating with the head of the rib, right? The head of any bone is usually the proximal part, but it's a swelling at the tip of a bone, at an epiphysis of a bone. So here's the head. The head of a rib, again, has an articulating surface that articulates with the facet. And then it moves posteriorly, but you're saying, but wait a second, I got a bunch of ribs in the front, but here's this rib moving posteriorly, okay, and that's because it curves back around. We're going to see how it curves in just a little bit to help form the thoracic cavity. So here's the head, here's a depression before you get this other raised area, that's what we call the neck. That makes sense because your cervical region is kind of narrow compared to your head and shoulders. And unless you're a football player. And then here is, right, another rough raised area which attaches a ligament between the tubercle on a rib and the transverse process of a thoracic vertebrae. Okay, so you're going to see the head and this tubercle. Sometimes it's called a conoid tubercle. Look in the diagrams and look in your lab manual is how I have it labeled. And then the rib bends anteriorly, we call that the angle, and then it's going to straighten out, and that's what we call the shaft of a rib. So, That's a nice thoracic vertebrae because you can see these articulating surfaces on it very easily. The vertebral foramen is pretty much oval in shape. The spinous process, you're going to see in lab, is nice and sharp and pointed. And it points inferiorly. It angles inferiorly as well, something that we can't really appreciate on this illustration. What about the previous illustration? Can we see that? Sort of. I can see it angled inferiorly. All right, so here's the shaft. Here's the angle of a rib. Okay, so here's the head. Here's the neck. Here's the tubercle. Angle, the shaft. This end of the rib, okay, is what you, it attaches to cartilage, which then goes to the sternum to help make up the anterior part of the thoracic cage. And since there's a costal cartilage attached right here, we call this the costal end of the rib. Okay, and then if we look right here, I also see a depression in a, in this bone, and that's what we call a groove. You could call it a sulcus just as well as a groove, but typically we call it a groove. And there are important blood vessels and nerves that follow this rib to get to the anterior part of your body so they don't have to cut across your lungs. And that would be really difficult because your lungs are moving around all the time, every time you take a breath. Okay, so here's a nice safe way of getting to the anterior part of your body. Okay, so let's put these ribs together with the vertebral column and also the breastplate or the breastbone. And in us, that is called the sternum. So here is the sternum, and that's the name that I want you to know. I don't think I ever ask you for common names of things, but you might want to know because if you're familiar with it already. All right, so here we see a body of a vertebrae and a rib attached to it. So what kind of vertebrae is this? It's got to be thoracic. Okay, and here is another thoracic vertebrae because there's a rib attached to it. And what about this one? This is just a transverse process here and here, just like I see a transverse process here and here. So since it doesn't have a rib attached to it, it's got to be a lumbar vertebrae, right? Okay, so we want to understand the designation of some of these ribs. Some ribs have a costal cartilage that go from the costal end over to the sternum. Rib number one does. 2, 3, 4. So I'm just counting down just like the number of vertebrae, right? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right? And I still see cartilage going directly to the sternum. There's some ligaments between these vertebrae. And then number 7 still has a cartilage that goes directly to the sternum. So any rib that has a costal cartilage going and attaching directly to the sternum, we call that a true rib. So 1 through 7 are true ribs. But you're saying, but I see some other cartilage down over here. But let's look at this cartilage on rib number 8. It comes from the costal end, and where does it go? It goes to the costal cartilage of rib number 7. It doesn't go directly to the sternum. So we're going to call that a false rib. So any rib that doesn't attach directly to the sternum is a false rib. So the 8 through 12 are false ribs, and you can see why. And these over here don't have any direct attachment to anything, so they're a false rib. But since they don't have an attachment to anything, we also call them false ribs. So you could say false floaters, these are floating ribs. Floating ribs. I maybe misspoke. These floating ribs right here are false ribs, right? But not every false rib is a floating rib. Okay, that's pretty obvious on this illustration right here. Was there a question? You were just going to straighten me out on floating versus false or vice versa? Okay, I figured it out. Okay, and that takes us to the sternum. The sternum has got 3 parts, 3 bones, and us, they've probably already ossified together these joints. And so this top part of the sternum is called the manubrium. The large or the long middle part is called the body. And then this little dinky part down over here is called the xiphoid process. And there's a really important muscle that attaches here. You probably can figure out what it is. It's an abdominal muscle. Okay, that six-pack muscle attaches right here. That's why we call it a process. And when the manubrium comes together with the sternum, you could palpate this on yourself. Right? You have a little protuberance right here, and we call that the sternal angle, because it sticks out a little bit. Some people actually have a hole in their sternum. Right here, it hasn't ossified completely, probably never will. It's no big deal. As a matter of fact, I don't even know what that hole is called, but you could guess what it's called. What would you guess? Yeah, the sternal foramen. Probably a membrane over it anyway. Okay, we talk about the sternum in a little bit more detail in lab because we're concerned about the xiphoid process. Kind of reminds me of a coccyx, but clinically it could be really important because it can fracture, it can break away from the body, and then it can migrate around inside the thoracic cavity. And when it does, it's really sharp, right? It can lacerate blood vessels, or it can lacerate the heart, or lacerate the lungs, and result in a hemorrhage, right? So that would not be good. So we talk about that a little bit in lab. Let me look at my notes right here. Okay, so we talked about cervical vertebrae, thoracic vertebrae. What about lumbar vertebrae? How are we going to tell a lumbar vertebrae from another kind of vertebrae? Let's see what we got right here. I see a kind of typical one that looks more like thoracic. I see some cervical vertebrae and for sure a thoracic vertebrae. I don't see any lumbar vertebrae. So let me just pull this one up and describe what it would be like. The vertebral foramen in a lumbar vertebrae is going to be more heart-shaped. It's not going to be oval like you see right here. So if you look down into the vertebral foramen, it's going to look like a heart. All right, so that's going to be easy to remember. The spinous process is just going to be square and sticking almost straight posteriorly. This is a thoracic vertebrae, so this spinous process looks kind of short, but it's actually really long. It's just angled inferiorly. So it's really long, but it's pointing down, so on this perspective, it doesn't look like it's very big. Okay. So since we're talking about, so that's how you would tell a lumbar vertebrae. Another way you could tell is that it has a big, massive vertebral body, and it does not have any costal facets right here. Right? Because if it did, then it would be what kind of vertebrae? That would be a thoracic vertebrae, right? But it doesn't have any ribs attached to it. All right, so if we consider the spinous process, once again, it's going to be long and narrow, angled inferiorly for a thoracic vertebrae. For a lumbar vertebrae, it's going to be short. It's going to be about this long, but it doesn't angle downward at all. And it looks like just kind of a square flag sitting off the vertebral arch. But if this is a cervical vertebrae, how would we have to modify this drawing right here if this were a cervical? Yeah, I haven't talked about it, so I don't want to mention that just yet. But we did talk about something already. In the transverse processes, there are what? Vertebral foramina. So that's how you'd have to modify this particular illustration, put foramina right here. But you'd also have to modify it in another way. And this is where I heard a really good comment. The spinous process on a cervical vertebrae just doesn't come back in a singular form like this, but it bifurcates, kind of looks like a fork. It has two points to it. So we say that cervical vertebrae have a bifid spinous process. And if we look at some cervical vertebrae, let's see, cervical vertebrae. I know I saw one somewhere. Cervical vertebrae. Okay, not very prominent on C1 and C2, so that's why I'm not showing you this. Guess what? You might have to go to lab to see it. Oh, no, here. Okay, so here is lumbar. Right, so this shows the facets very nicely. I'm not thoracic, so it shows the facets very nicely. And the spinous process is what? Long and narrow and pointing inferiorly on a thoracic vertebrae. And if we go to cervical vertebrae, okay, we can't see the transverse foramina because this is just not the right aspect there. No, that's probably not it. All right, but here's the spinous process. And look at this funny spinous process on cervical vertebrae. It's what we call bifurcated, or it makes a bifid spinous process on cervical vertebrae. And you'll only find that on cervical vertebrae, no other kind of vertebrae. That's how you would tell them apart from each other. Okay. So we don't want to have, this is not a normal healthy vertebral column, because I see the bodies of these vertebrae rubbing up against each other, and they would quickly wear out. So there's a special kind of disc that fits between the bodies. We call that an intervertebral disc. And an intervertebral disc has two components to it.
Let's see if I can find a picture of an intervertebral disc. I don't see one. Why is that? No, this is just a nice comparison between cervical, and here's that heart-shaped vertebral foramen in a lumbar. Here. Perfect. Okay, so here we see the vertebral foramen filled with the spinal cord. We're going to not really appreciate this until we get to the nervous system. And here are some nerves leaving through an intervertebral foramen. And now we can't see the body of this vertebrae because it's covered with an intervertebral disc. And this is an abnormal disc for the following reason. The center part is kind of gooey, jelly-like material, right? Kind of acts like a pillow. And we call this the nucleus pulposus of the disc. And it's held in place by this very fibrous cartilage right here. And that's what we call the annulus fibrosus, made out of fibrocartilage. And annulus just means a circle of something. And normally, if it's a healthy disc, this annulus is nice and sound all the way around. But on this one, I see it bulging out. So there was a rupture in the annulus fibrosus, right? And we call that a herniation. And then the nucleus pulposus can start to push out here as well. And when it does, it presses up against this nerve. And that's what can cause deficits in motion in a person's body. They might not be able to control an arm or a leg depending on what level of the spinal cord is involved. We call that a motor deficit. Or it might cause a sensory deficit or even a strange sensation or pain sensation in that part of the body where this nerve is going. So you could have tremendous pain in your ankle or your hand. If this nerve that's coming from your ankle or your hand gets impinged upon this herniation from this disc. Right, so there's no damage to your hand or ankle, but this is where you feel it. And that can be really, really excruciating and severe in some people to where they have to have surgery on this disc to repair it or remove it. Okay, what else do we want to say about the... What part of the skeleton were we talking about just now? Nobody knows? Oh, yeah, tell me. We can't leave unless you tell me. Yeah, axial skeleton. What? Axial skeleton, right, as opposed to appendicular skeleton. Okay, so here are a couple other things that are on your list. Here we have a fetal skull, or it could even be a neonate. Neonate is what? Newborn baby. And here is the frontal bone. Here's the parietal bone. And remember, these bones are developed from intramembranous ossification. They develop from membranes because they're flat bones. And before you're born, these flat bones don't fuse together. I don't see any sutures right here. There's a space between them. And then even in certain parts, right here's a really big space. So there's a membrane right here. There's a membrane running down right here, which eventually will ossify and become bone. And here's another membrane over here. I see one over here. And that's important for a couple reasons. And I think I forgot to talk about one of the reasons in lab. But one reason is for parturition. So here is the skull. And if the skull didn't squeeze down and change shape from being spherical to kind of elongated, then nobody would ever be born because your head couldn't fit through the birth canal. All right, so during parturition, those strong, smooth muscles push the baby out, and as it's going through the birth canal, the head kind of just squishes through the birth canal because these bones aren't really formed together yet. So the shape of the head can actually change, and then when the head pops out, the head sort of pops into its original shape, but not quite. If you look at a newborn baby, their head probably still looks a little squished, maybe a little strange. All right, so that's one reason for these, what we call soft spots. Okay, that's not the scientific name. That's the common name for these things. The scientific name is fontanelle. And sometimes fontanelle is not spelled that way. Sometimes there's just one L at the end of the word. Either way you spell it is fine. This fontanelle is fancy. You know, if you like that, that's fine with me. Another reason why the bones of the cranium haven't fused together is because the brain develops very, very rapidly, faster than bone can. Right? So if this was a completely ossified skull, then the brain wouldn't have room to grow. And then there would be severe neurological deficit in that individual. So these fontanelles are here so that these bony plates can actually spread apart and allow for growing of the brain. So that's real important. So these fontanelles, there are four that I want you to know. Here's the anterior fontanelle between the frontal and parietal bones. Here is what we call the sphenoidal fontanelle, just superior to the sphenoid. And then down by the mastoid process is the mastoid fontanelle. And then posterior to the anterior fontanelle is the posterior fontanelle. So those are the four fontanelles. And the strange thing about these fontanelles is their duration. How long do they exist in somebody? How long does a baby have these things? Yes, very long time. I thought it would be maybe a couple months because it would be really important to protect that brain because these soft spots are very susceptible to puncture wounds, which would damage the brain. Also, shaking or vibration or pressure can damage the brain as well with these fontanelles right here. So you always got to protect the skull of a newborn up to 2 years, right, because you don't want to damage their brain because the skull bones haven't ossified, haven't fused together to form those sutures. All right, so that's another important reason for those fontanelles. Now, in an adult, there's going to be a joint between the frontal bone and the parietal bone over here. What do we call that joint? What do we call that joint in an adult skull? Okay, that's a suture, right? When I was looking at that skull picture at the very beginning of lecture, I didn't really go over the sutures very well, but I think we went over them in lab, right? So these ossified joints are what we call sutures between the bones of the cranium. And they're basically an immovable joint because they have big, strong ligaments that go from one bone to another. Plus, they're not straight. They have a lot of convolutions which lock the bones together as well. Okay, so anybody have a question on axial skeleton? In lab, I didn't go over, I think I went over sinuses, paranasal sinuses, couple in the frontal bone. Couple in the ethmoid, couple in the sphenoid, actually just one big in the sphenoid, and then here's the maxillary sinus in both maxilla. And they're loaded with lymphatic tissue, which fights infection, bacteria trying to get into your body from your mouth, your nose, and even to some extent your eyes. We're infected a lot by touching our eyes. Okay. One other thing that I think I want to mention to help you remember, here's that sphenoid sinus. I don't see ethmoid sinus, but it would be up over here. Oh, here's that crista galli that I was talking about, that thing sticking up. I see the cribriform plate with olfactory foramina in it. So here's the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid bone, which helps make up the nasal septum, which sits right on top of the vomer, which kind of looks like a knife blade right here. This right here is just cartilage. Okay, so that's not really a bone of the skull that you have to know. So starting here with a vomer or maxilla or nasal bone, we're not really worried about these nasal cartilages. Okay, so that's it for axial skeleton. You might have to know the foramina, but look at that for the lecture exam coming up, but you should also know them for the practicum that you're having this week. Okay, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, please. Thank you.